eyes. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Schleter, Judge Plaskin, Paul Brooks, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Judge Randall J. Schleter presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. And welcome to the Court of Appeals. June 5, the first matter on our calendar, file A18-1978, Cambria Company LLC versus M&amp;M Creative Laminates, Inc. And it looks like the parties and counsel are ready to proceed. I understand one counsel for each will be proceeding. And so, appellate's counsel, as soon as you're ready, you may introduce yourself and proceed.
I will. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm David Herr for the appellant, Cambria. I believe this case is a fairly simple case. It arises from a decision on a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, so it presents a pure legal issue. But it's also a very important case. It involves a question of immense interest for the parties to this case and also really the entire Minnesota business community, because Cambria was denied a dismissal of a counterclaim it was entitled to have dismissed, subjecting it to expensive, protracted, and pointless litigation over a, quote, franchise, close quote, that never was. And the order also resulted in, I think, a settlement, or not even a settlement, just a claim that is massive and ultimately will keep this case from being resolved. It's of interest to every Minnesota manufacturer that distributes something elsewhere. Ones that think they're franchisors, and ones like Cambria that certainly don't think they're franchisors, but come to court and find out that someone else thinks they are. The case is simple, though, because the relevant facts on a motion to dismiss are the facts in the claim involved, in this case, the counterclaim. And the core issue here, does the counterclaim state a claim for breach of the Minnesota Franchise Act that survives a Rule 12 motion?
Mr. Herr, you started out by making reference to the effect it would have on other, the importance, I'm assuming, is what you're getting to of this court answering a question of other companies. Is there anything in the record? I saw that phrase in the district court's order as well, and I'm just curious, was there anything that was presented at the motion hearing, any evidence of in the form of impact that this decision would have on existing franchisors here in Minnesota?
No, there was not factual information about that. I mean, the court obviously would be aware of the importance of the issue and the fact there are, without quantifying it or identifying, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of manufacturers that are not franchisors that sell things outside of Minnesota that would have to be developed. And the point is, again, that's not even germane to the underlying issue so much. It does bear on certification, and it clearly was of moment to the district court when you read the certification order.
It's your position that whether or not Cambria is a franchisor is a factual finding, correct?
Ultimately, there would be a factual issue there, mm-hmm. but there is no factual issue as to whether it is an entity that's in this transaction that's subject to the Minnesota Franchise Act. So the broad academic question might be a fact issue. The question here is a purely legal question under the Minnesota Franchise Act. And we have explained in some detail how the Minnesota Franchise Act came to be. And I think it's important. It provides the context. This court really needs to begin with Section 19 of that statute. That statute gives rise certainly to the ambiguity, and we see it in the cases, the ambiguity as to whether there's extraterritorial reach of the statute. Does it apply to an out-of-state franchisor or distributor who doesn't do any business in Minnesota, you know, the contact with Minnesota is the franchisor, would-be or claimed franchisor's location in Minnesota. But ADC.19 either applies, either excludes all extraterritorial application. It has a specific language excluding transactions. And the question is whether the what the role is of the clause concerning sales and offers to sell in that statute. If that's viewed as limiting the reach of the statute, which is sort of a strained reading, because the statute by its terms expressly says it applies to the entire statute, sections 0.01 all the way to 0.22. If it applies to the whole Franchise Act, then you reach one result. If that term is viewed as a qualifying term only relating to sales, offers to sell, and sales of franchises, then that takes you to look at the other provisions of the statute. Either way, we get a clear ruling from this court, or we're entitled to it, that says the statute does not apply extraterritorially.
But even if it does, does that resolve all the issues in this litigation?
Yes. Issues in the litigation? No, it would not. It resolves the issue of the Minnesota Franchise Act,
But courts generally don't favor piecemeal litigation, though.
I think that's right. In this certification order here, the district court couldn't have been clearer in his reluctance to order this willy-nilly. He was just perfectly appropriately constrained in certifying the question, or restrained in certifying the question, but concluded that this is one of the rare cases where certification was appropriate. He applied the correct standards, and at least from the certification orders I've read, this is one of the more robust certification orders I've seen. And the truth is the franchise...
What do you mean by robust? Because the certification question certainly seems broad, and perhaps maybe it's too broad.
I don't think it is. It's very explicit and tailored to the issues in this case. And the Franchise Act claim is the 800-pound gorilla in this case. The other issues are fairly straightforward.
But ultimately, this will not resolve all the issues in the litigation, though.
It will not resolve the entire case.
And that's one of the concerns about having this type of certification question, which courts are generally reluctant to do unless it will. That's one of the key factors we look at, is whether it will take care of all the issues.
The judge explained his view that this would resolve an important issue.
An important issue, but not all of them.
Not all of them. That's correct. But
district courts have to deal with issues of first impression all the time. I realize that this is a question that hasn't been litigated extensively, but that's what district courts do, is make decisions, and then they get reviewed by our court to see whether or not there's error, and then potentially by the Supreme Court.
It's not really an issue of first impression. It's an issue that needs to be resolved. There are several cases. We've cited them.
Right, federal cases.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
They're not precedential cases that answer the question before this court in a direct way, at least not to the district court judge. We think it ought to be resolved, and certainly at this point, it needs to be resolved.
Mr. Herr, there's a counterclaim also, if I recall, a breach of contract. And in terms of the importance, even if you separate the issue of whether it resolves litigation, which clearly here it isn't, I understand the litigation is ongoing as we're here today, and that's a major factor. But even as to the importance, my question is, what, as a practical matter, is the difference of the damages that are alleged in the counterclaim, whether or not the MFA claim continues?
Well, one very big difference, and it's by not by any means not the only one, but one very big one, is the Franchise Act applies a right to recover costs and attorney's fees that aren't present in the other claims. So that becomes a litigation protracting force in the litigation. And I think the district court judge clearly must have recognized that in his view that certifying this order and having it answered would expedite the ultimate resolution of the case and avoid a retrial, as Judge Reyes points out. Yes, in the general scheme of things, we would most often try the case, come back, and someone would be appealing then. This, I think the interests of justice are served certainly by having the issue resolved now in this case. I think it's important for the court to recognize, and I can't stress the, you know, the ambiguity in the statute really is it's an analytical challenge to deal with. Two courts have reached sort of the opposite results on it, which underscores the ambiguity. In this court's decision from Monday, Peterson versus Western National, the court said the statutory phrase is ambiguous because the parties have identified more than one reasonable interpretation of it. Here, we have a provision that two former Minnesota jurists sitting as United States District Court judges in the District of Minnesota have reached exactly opposite results on. And what stronger basis can there be to find that ambiguity? If we say that the statute, that on one view, the third paragraph of footnote 4 in M&M's district court brief said the only facts that are crucial to the question of the application of the statute, nearly every event of relevance to this matter took place in Pennsylvania. Cambria solicited M&M in Pennsylvania, entered into a contract with M&M in Pennsylvania, performed the contract in Pennsylvania, terminated the contract with M&M in Pennsylvania, and interfered with M&M's local contacts in Pennsylvania. And at page 3 of that memo, for its entire history, M&M has had no customers in Minnesota. The Minnesota legislature, in adopting this statute, never intended to provide a remedy to a Pennsylvania company solely because it became a customer of a Minnesota company. We go through that legislative history.
Well, but do we need to get into the legislative history in the first instance? Of course, well, go ahead.
You could say no, because Cambria wins either way. If you don't look at the legislative history, you read the statute as saying it doesn't apply unless the deal was entered into in Minnesota, not the case here, not alleged here. The case with the contract was delivered to them in Minnesota, not the case here, or it was with a Minnesota entity, not the case here. So that way you wouldn't have to go into the legislative history.
That argument, though, seems to... I'm concerned about the breadth of it. I mean, what you're talking about are fact-specific parts of it, of your case as to why it doesn't apply in this particular matter. And yet the question that has been certified is a very, very broad one, whether MFA in general applies to non-Minnesota residents. Those seem to be two disparate things there.
Well, the Minnesota legislature didn't pass a statute relating to our case.
I understand that, but it
passed a broad law, and the judge certified the question of, does that law apply to out-of-state entities whose only contact with Minnesota is entering into a contract with the Minnesota company?
I guess my question is this really a fact-specific inquiry as to whether the MFA applies to a particular part non-Minnesota party based on the particular facts, based on The facts that you just enunciated right now.
Those facts come directly out of the counterclaim and the arguments that they made, the admissions they make, but it's consistent with the allegations of the counterclaim. Under Rule 12, it's not a factual analysis. It's a legal question.
I understand that part of it, but my point is the particular facts in this case are what you seem to be arguing to support the fact that the MFA does not apply to Cambridge under the, in this matter.
I don't know how to answer that other than to say that that's what Rule 12 we test, is how the allegations of this pleading fare under Minnesota law. And this one is insufficient as a matter of law, and they can't cure it. The facts are the facts. The factual statements are clear. I'll save my remaining time for my rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Respondent, counsel, you may proceed. And if you'd please identify yourself for the record once you reach the podium.
Oh, I'm sorry.
If you make sure to introduce yourself when you reach the podium, please. Thank you.
Do you have enough paper towels?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. I always like to be the center of attention.
That's a pretty minor thing.
Yeah, if that's the worst, that's right.
Also, that podium will go up if you'd like it to. There's a switch to raise the level of the podium if that's more comfortable.
That would be good.
Thank you.
Sure.
Good morning, Your Honors. Leland Shermer for Appellee Respondent, M&M Creative Land Minutes. What was interesting to me about Mr. Herr's presentation was that he never mentioned Section 14 of the MFA. M&M asserts that it was wrongfully terminated under Section 14 of the MFA. That section has no, as Cambria calls it, geographical limiting language in it. That section also has no ambiguity in it. We argued in our respondent's brief that you do not get into a discussion of legislative history in this state or in most states, just like a contract matter, just like a patent claim, until the threshold proof has been made of ambiguity. Judge Slater, your opinion 2 days ago reiterated that very established principle. And here, the provision that Cambria is accused of violating is admitted by Cambria not to be ambiguous. Their opening brief does recite the law that there must be ambiguity before you get to discussion of legislative intent, but they never got back to it. We challenged that, I think, 3 times in our respondent's brief. Total silence in reply, and essentially an admission through silence. And why is that? Because Section 14 is not ambiguous. One of the things in that opinion that was referenced, the Peterson decision of 2 days ago, it was an insurance bad faith claim, and the question there was whether under Section 604.18 the insurance company had an absence of a reasonable basis for denying benefits. This court, citing American Tower, said that when the language therein is subject to more than one reasonable reading, then it is ambiguous. I call this case the case of free-floating ambiguity. What Cambria is saying is, forget about the one provision that's at issue, Section 14, and look all around the statute. And if you look at other parts, you'll see that there's some ambiguity in the other parts. Well, we're talking about Section 14, and there's no ambiguity. So all of the discussion about legislative history never gets there.
Does your argument, though, Mr. Schirmer, hinge upon the first question that has been advanced to us, the first certified question, whether or not the MFA even applies here?
No, I don't believe my argument does. That issue is a hypothetical question because it's not just does it apply. The way it was framed by Cambria and found by Judge Vandalist was, does it apply, and this goes to what Judge Reyes was raising, where the only alleged connection between the party asserting that claim and the state of Minnesota is that the purported franchisor has an office in Minnesota. There are so many fact issues on that, and that's one of the reasons why we cited the Peter Martin affidavit, which was submitted, albeit in the federal court in Pittsburgh, in order to secure a transfer, but cited by, or referenced, I should say, as having been reviewed by Judge Vandalist in making his decision, where Martin, to the extent he covers what really is going on here, he's correct, although he's not complete. Cambria is up here making slabs of material. M&M is in Pittsburgh. M&M has its customers in that geographic footprint. But M&M and Cambria are the franchise, not M&M and M&M's customers. So when we alleged that M&M's customers are all in Pennsylvania, Eastern Ohio, Northern West Virginia, the so-called tri-state area, that's true. But that's not the franchise. The franchise is between M&M and Cambria. Millions of dollars have gone back and forth, and millions of dollars of goods and services have gone back and forth between Minnesota and Pennsylvania in the relationship that is at stake here. So it is very fact-intensive. I think that Cambria recognized that the degree of contact of a party asserting a Franchise Act claim is a relevant factor, but they have seriously understated the degree of connection, and it's a fact issue that can't be resolved at a Rule 12 motion stage. So this is why this is a premature appeal. There is no harm to Cambria to appeal this when every other issue is appealed, like in every other case, because a lot of things could happen. One, they could win the claim at trial. If they win the claim at trial, then all of these interesting issues you're being asked to decide are moot. They really are hypothetical. There's no compelling reason. You talked about this idea that, I think it was Judge Reyes talked about the idea that there are 10 causes of action here. This is only one of them. What was also interesting about Mr. Herr's presentation is he came in and argued that Section 19 applies and is the controlling analysis here. That's not what their brief says. Their opening brief goes at length about why Section 19 doesn't apply. So I'm not sure which way it works, but if Section 19 does apply, there are three different ways to satisfy it, all heavily fact-dependent, and which we can prove. One is the offer for sale originating in Minnesota, sale of the franchise. Surely it originated here because this is where Cambria is. So that on its face is satisfiable, if you will. The second was it accepted here? We have facts that will show it was accepted here. But again, this is a pleading. This isn't trial. And the third is if the franchisee is located here. Okay. If Section 19 applies, then maybe that third option is not very viable. But the other two clearly are. And this is way too premature to be addressing this issue. It is something on which this court would benefit by having a developed record. In addition, you asked about issue number one, Judge Hallbrooks. Everybody agrees that Judge Vandalist didn't decide the issue. He didn't decide it. In reply, Cambria argues, well, he effectively, implicitly must have because he didn't dismiss the claim. But he did not rule on it. So this is an error correction court that relies on a record and findings and reasoning and analysis by the trial judges of this state. You don't have that here. You're being asked to issue an advisory opinion on a naked record on this specific issue. It's just not there.
Mr. Shermer, how do you envision those factual, you're making reference to those elements in Section 19, 80C19. Do you envision the ultimate fact finder to make those, or do you envision a pretrial summary judgment motion after more discovery and facts for the same judge to make that decision prior to trial as to whether MFA applies?
It could be raised either way. It could be raised either way. I mean, it would be dependent on whether the parties moved on that ground. But if there was no pre-trial summary judgment motion on it, I believe it's part of the, if the statute applies, which the trial judge would have to decide, I believe it would be part of the party asserting the MFA claims burden to demonstrate that it can satisfy one of those three tests under Section 19, Subdivision 1.
And is your client's damages different under the breach of contract as it is under the MFA, besides Mr. Herr made the point about attorney's fees and costs?
I think the experts are still analyzing that, to be quite honest, but I think that there is a very strong claim that they're pretty much the same. If you look at count two, it's pled in the alternative. If it's not a franchise, it's still a common law contract. And when you send some guy in who tells you after almost a decade, you're terminated on the spot. Even if the matter is just adjudicated under common law principles in this state, it is not something that does not cause damage. I mean, you have to give people a minimum of reasonable notice here. So I think the short answer to your question is, one, we're not complete on that ourselves at the moment. We're still working with the experts. But two, it very well could be. That's the most I can give you at the moment. But certainly, as the standards for certification look at it, there are cases, appellate cases, saying that a very similar claim that's not been the subject of certification is good reason not to grant certification. And here, count two is the twin brother of count one in terms of proof, in terms of evidence, maybe in terms of damage. And certainly it's not up on appeal. So where would we get by having you adjudicate this at this point when that claim is still going forward, unless it's disposed of at summary judgment, which I don't think it will. I mean, there's no real dispute. We were terminated on the spot. That's, at a minimum, not reasonable notice. So getting back to the larger issues, I think that if you look at this case in the larger sense, Judge Slater asked about the hundreds, if not thousands, of contracts that might be affected here. Cambria, in its reply brief seeking certification after we filed our opposition, threw that line into their paper. There's not one shred of evidence that they pointed to. The court picked up on it, for whatever reason, and repeated it. It, too, didn't cite any evidence. And the court's ruling, of course, came out after we had filed our papers, so it's not like we could have objected. We objected here. This is the place that we could next comment on that. That finding has no bearing. As we argued in our papers, where are all the business interests and the amicus briefs, if this is so critical? This statute's been around for almost 50 years. This is not an important case or issue in the relevant sense. It could have impact on some people, yes, but importance starts with whether it disposes of and otherwise justifies variation from the usual final judgment rule where there's one appeal and everything goes up at once. That's just not the case here. So it doesn't satisfy that. In terms of whether or not this is an issue on which there are substantial grounds for difference of opinion, I noticed in the Cambria reply that they argued we never addressed that, we conceded it. That's not true. Pages 47 to 49 in detail go through every one of their cases, pointing out why, when you stack up on one side the fact that this court twice has allowed out-of-state plaintiffs to assert MFA claims, albeit not with a challenge to that issue, but they certainly did assert it, and there certainly is precedent from this court on it. Plus, you have the Candleman case from the Federal District Court, where the Federal District Court squarely addressed the issue that when you have a choice of law provision, that means all of the law, not just the parts you like. And that's really what's going on here that's really unusual, is that the original motion to dismiss sought to dismiss our Pennsylvania Common Law Franchise Act claim, which was part of count one. And I think it was dismissed because Judge Vandalist agreed with Cambria and said, choice of law clause, Minnesota, out goes Pennsylvania Common Law Franchise claim. So the choice of law provision is enforceable against M&M. But when we assert the Minnesota claim, M&M's response is, well, the choice of law doesn't apply to us now because you don't live here. And that's what I think Judge Vandalist's opinion was concerned about. There's an inequity here. And in fact, it could rise to the level of a constitutional problem if the choice of law clause is not applied equally to all parties in this case, inside Minnesota, outside Minnesota. And he talked about that. He called it a black hole reasoning, and I call it the heads I win, tails you lose reasoning. How can they seek and obtain relief of a dismissal of our Pennsylvania claim on the basis of the choice of law provision and then run from the choice of law provision when Judge Vandalist said, you have a choice of law provision. They're subject to jurisdiction here. You hailed them into court here. So are you. You got to live with the very clause that you put into your form agreement. And so we think it's very clear that this should not come up now. It is so fact-intensive, it is much more appropriate, and will allow this court or even Judge Vandalist to have a more informed determination of these issues when there's a record. Right now, there's no record. There's a pleading. And in addition to the fact that there's a pleading, it can be amended. We did not go through and recite every allegation that might meet every part of every provision of the statute. If we should have, there's no harm here. We're allowed to amend. Amendment is freely allowed, and it hasn't and won't change a thing in the preparation of this case. So with that, Your Honor, I'll thank you for your time.
Thank you. Bella, you may respond.
I'll see if I can get up to the lectern without spilling anything. This case, Section 14, is what this case is about. Section 19 establishes the ambiguity in the two ways we get to there. He would, it's a termination provision. And I think you're, frankly, being misled to say that the breach of contract claim is just the same as the franchise claim. The termination provision that's in the Franchise Act is much different from Minnesota common law. On a contract that's otherwise terminable at will, the only way he gets to an $82 million claim is by saying that we have a non-terminable contract that would have extended into perpetuity, and it's just wrong. The other thing that's wrong about the argument you just heard is it would turn the Minnesota...
Are you talking about whether it's an indefinite contract or one in perpetuity? Is that what you're referring to there?
I'm referring to the argument about how the MFA, Minnesota Franchise Act, would apply even extraterritorially. Under that definition that they're arguing for, a California franchisee from an Oregon franchisor could come to Minnesota and say, apply our act. Apply it to us. We want the provisions. The so-called black hole he talks about is the result of the fact that Pennsylvania doesn't have a statute that provides a meaningful remedy to him or to them. Pennsylvania has, and we put this in our brief, twice considered it, twice rejected it. So the Pennsylvania citizen can't really come to Minnesota and say, oh, you shouldn't apply the law we agreed to apply here. We want our home state law to apply, but our home state law doesn't provide us a remedy, so we want Minnesota law. That's just not Minnesota law.
And Mr. Herr, on that point, Mr. Shermer did point out that the flip side would then be true. Your client agreed and demanded the Minnesota choice of forum. Would that not answer the question? Has the judge ruled and questioned?
First of all, I think the choice of forum is beside, I think we're talking about the choice of law to be applied, not where it gets litigated. But if it's Minnesota law, we think it's clear. The statute doesn't apply extraterritorially, either definitionally under Section 19 or looking at the entire act as a whole, as you must. Section 14, yes, doesn't have expressed language in it on territorial or extraterritorial application, but it's part of a bigger whole, the Minnesota Franchise Act.
Right, but we look at Section 4, when we're looking at Section 14, we need to look at that particular provision, that particular section, and look at the language there. And there's nothing about territory there. There's no limitation. So don't we have to assume that the legislature knew it could have put it in there just as it put in other sections of the statute?
No, if you look at the history at the time.
No, let's put aside the history. Let's just look at the four corners of the statute, because we start with that section alone when we do the analysis.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. I think
in what way?
The whole statute.
When we're looking at a section of a statute, though, we look at the language there, and we look at, and we determine whether or not the language is plain and unambiguous.
I think that's under the cases we've cited. I think that's wrong. I think that you look to the statute as a whole.
You do look to the statute. I mean, you do have to look at the statute, but you have to look at the particular provision, and particularly even following your view there. I mean, you do need to look at the whole, but you also need to look at that particular section. And when you look at that section, there's no territorial language. There's no territorial restriction. There is territorial restrictions in other sections of the MFA.
Well, look at Section 20.19. I think you look at there first. That statute applies to all the sections, 0.01 to 0.22. So I think you do need to look at that statute. And if you decide that that somehow doesn't apply to 14 is between 0.01 and 0.22, then you look to the fact, the context. I mean, I'm not talking about legislative history of legislators' speeches on the subject of the territorial application. I'm talking about the history of the legislation adopted. The last time the legislature adopted a substantive provision, the law applied only for enforcement by the Department of Commerce. It later came to create a private cause of action. And it didn't, and therefore, in a statute that had these other territorial limitations, I think it's clear, it should be clear that the legislature wasn't contemplating creating a statute. You don't have to expressly, Minnesota Franchise Act doesn't apply to the requirement to register a franchise before you sell it. There's a provision that prohibits carving out or creating additional special rights under the statute. That doesn't apply extraterritorially. There's nothing to suggest that Minnesota would, in that context of this entire statute, carve out and create an extraterritorial application when it doesn't even require registration. There's no logic to that, and that's the way the statute reads. We think both questions should be answered in the negative, and the case should, Minnesota Act claim should be dismissed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you to both parties, and we'll take the matter under advisement. I neglected to note that we will address the motion to strike in response to it in our order as well. Thank you very much. Because I have recused myself from the next proceeding, I will excuse myself. Judge Cochran will make her way in, but it's nice to see familiar faces. You make yourself comfortable as she does come in for the next hearing. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. was going to. Since it, yeah.
It doesn't matter.
No, no.
Okay, okay.
Or do you want to move?
No, no.
Great, thank you.
Next case on our calendar this morning is Esther Schmalz versus the Commissioner of